Welcome to this episode of the Rising Stars of Turf, brought to you by Earthworks and Dryject. Our guest today is Carson Latott of the USGA. Carson, thanks for joining us here today.
Absolutely. Appreciate being here. And, you know, it's funny that you reached out about this because I've had a nice relationship with TurfNet that goes back over a decade. In fact, last year actually would have been the anniversary of getting to work with TurfNet, doing an internship over in Ireland. So when you reached out, that's a very friendly brand to see and continue that partnership with.
Well, that's good to hear. Appreciate the kind words. So now you are with the USGA's apprenticeship program, I remember when this was launched, pretty much the bullet points were to, and correct me if I'm wrong, basically to supply training to where and eliminate barriers to entry in the field for certain demographics, and to also get them to a point where they could attain a livable wage in the turf business. But I believe that was the original goal when this was founded a few years ago. And is that still accurate? And has there been anything added to that punch list?
Yeah. So, I think you have to break it down and look at a specific person, right? So taking a person as following them as a case study to see, okay, where have we actually busted a barrier, right, and gotten through something. So take an individual, let's say, for example, that's in the program. We have a woman named Heather. Who came to us by way of a golf course in town, local municipal course, and now works for Pinehurst Resort, primarily on course number 4. And so she's actually worked a couple different careers, and she's now sort of in this like second or third shift with a family to support, and is looking for something that she can apply her talents to. She's always had a green thumb, but it was a matter of figuring out a way to utilize that. And so her being a woman automatically, right, that is a person that's coming from a very non-traditional background in the turf industry, representing a very small percentage of our industry, and especially those in a leadership role. And so she comes in, she's looking at it as another career, and she can't just drop everything and go and attend a university program for preparation to get into the industry. And we know that those programs are, phenomenal programs. I myself am a result of the 4-year program at Michigan State, and we want to help and service those programs, but we know that that's maybe just not feasible for everybody. And so for her in particular, she has younger children that she needs to support, as well as, through time, but also financially, right? Has to put food on the table. And so for her, it was essential to get education without dropping everything. So a program like this, she was able to sign up for. Tuition's free. All she has to do is pursue it and spend her time doing it, which is a very valuable asset for folks. And so what we do is we position the time of class in the afternoon so that they can work full time from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. And then come to class from 2:30 to 4:00. So for her, that barrier of balancing family and work, we overcame that barrier of her being a woman in the industry and maybe not necessarily having a way to get into the industry and find mentorship. Once she gets into the program, we pair her with a mentor. And then we actually connected her to the Women in Turf Initiative that, now has taken on a global role, right? Expanding outside of the country and, really gets featured at our major championships, including this last year at the U.S. Open. Women in Turf were out in full force. And so Heather was able to mesh right in with that group. And so, barrier after barrier has now been busted. And now she's a couple months away from finishing the program, getting a journey worker card and really like escalating herself and her career. So you go out to the golf course and you talk to people that have worked with her, how detail oriented she is, how hard of a worker she is. And the biggest piece is how inquisitive she is. She's asking questions constantly. And that's because she's getting that in the program. And then now she's applying it at the course. So when you take a case study like her, it's easy to see all these things that have been a celebration of success. And then when you take a step back and you look at the quantitative evidence, we see that our program is much more diverse than the typical program, especially representing the cross cut of the industry. And then we also see the ability for us to offer free tuition for those students that are in the program, and then pairing that with mentorship in the field as they complete on-the-job training. So, there are most certainly challenges associated, right? But as you look at the 30,000-foot lens, man, there's wins all over the place.
Yeah, let's backtrack a little bit and take us back to the birth of this program. How did it start, and whose idea was it?
Yeah, so I think much akin to Sir Isaac Newton sitting under a tree and having an apple fall on him. As I understand it, the original conversations were underneath of a tree out on Course 10 as it was being constructed at Pinehurst Resort. And so Jordan Booth and some of the leadership at Pinehurst Resort, as well as Chris Hartwiger and Cole Thompson from the USGA, along with Jordan Booth from the USGA, all got together and decided that something needed to be done locally. The program at Sandhills Community College had been a really great program for a while on the associate's degree side, but we needed a little bit something extra to add to it in this area to meet the need of our golf courses. And one of the needs that they had stated was for there to be education and professional development, but not to the level maybe where you would have in a traditional associate's or baccalaureate degree, where somebody would have to drop everything and commit to that versus being able to work and do school at the same time. So those conversations were had underneath of that fateful tree out there, which I'm sure we'll identify and put a plaque under at some point down the road. But they transitioned over to Sandhills Community College, and our partners here at the college are phenomenal to work with and setting up these programs that are unique and novel in the workforce continuing education side of the college. There's all sorts of different programs that really don't fall under the typical umbrella, the typical timelines. They meet people where they're at and then meet the employers where they're at. So there's a lot less of the red tape and the stepping around things. It's we're going to develop a program that needs to get developed and get done. So Sandhills is the perfect place to do that. And now this upcoming year, we're expanding to Horry Georgetown Technical College with the second GAP site. And so they have also been a partner that has been just like Sandhills, where they say, yep, we know this needs to get done and we'll figure it out and we'll get it done. And that's where it's now going to happen down there. So those conversations originally happened over there and then it expanded across town to a bunch of different golf courses in our area. Who had superintendents and folks in leadership positions that had noticed the same thing, that they wanted to provide their employees more education, more training, hopefully mitigating some of that turnover and providing some pathways for folks to not only commit to a career in the industry, but commit to going up the ranks and assuming leadership positions and being more well-trained, well-skilled workers. So, it was easy in this town. There, you really cannot drive for more than a couple minutes and not pass a golf course. And so folks talk to each other, and it's a really well-connected, tight-knit community amongst the Sandhills. So it only made sense then that everybody would jump on board.
How many students, quote-unquote students, are currently in the program, and how many have gone through it to date?
Yeah, so last year we had 19 that completed the program. This year we'll have 14 that'll complete it. As we get into numbers and figuring out what works best, obviously we would want to take every single student that we possibly can every year to become an apprentice. But this program works well, and other apprenticeship programs across the country work well when there's a lot of people talk about it like a high touch service kind of thing. That ratio of teacher to student has to be balanced so that each one of the apprentices in the program feels that mentorship, feels the guidance. And so it's not really possible when you have one teacher and 100 students. There's a lot of people that get lost in the shuffle. And then working out the logistics of making site visits to those students at their golf courses. It takes me 3 weeks to get to every single student that's currently in the program when I go to do a wave of site visits. And so I want to make sure that I can dedicate time to each one of those students, and each one of them is well supported, well taken care of, and has somebody in their corner. So we want to keep those numbers around 20 for each cohort. And so this year we started out with that 20, and a couple folks along the way, decide that they want to get into a different career path. And some of the individuals that get into the program, they have spouses that might draw them out of state into a new situation. So those things happen. And, that's a demographic we're working with that are real people with real lives that have more at play than just the typical university student that might be able to drop everything and, live on campus and be immersed. So We'll try to stick around that 20 number. Might take a couple extra here and there, but it's a comfortable number that I know that I can manage with each one of the students and provide them with the proper mentorship. And we really like the in-person part of this program. You look at tons of studies out there for what it looks like for online education, especially at the community college level, really low success rates. It's just not engaging for individuals. We don't get the same high impact educational experiences when we deliver them online, especially this kind of subject area. You need to be in class. We need to be getting dirty. We need to be getting hands-on. We need to be working with each other. And that's a big part of it too, is that we don't just talk the talk. Like, we really do walk the walk with a cohort model. It's a professional learning community where everybody in class works with each other. Every project that we do has some sort of component where they're working with other individuals in the class. So by the time that they leave class, those people that came in that were all 20 individuals that didn't know each other are leaving as friends. And I was talking the other day with a couple other folks that run apprenticeship programs, and how the warm fuzzies, right? The true joy in seeing those students who a couple months previous were strangers to each other, all of a sudden going out on a Saturday night to play golf together, and they get to go to each other's courses and play. That's the kind of stuff that puts a smile on your face, knowing that you're building friendships for life.
When you make the rounds and go and visit with students who are part of this program, what does a typical visit with them entail?
Yeah, so the initial visit starts typically a week beforehand, where we're having conversations in class that the visit is going to be coming, and then the email correspondence with the students and the mentors are tasking them with preparation for that visit. And so for me, I lean heavily on professional objective building, and not only for the measurement of whether or not we're successful in any objectives that we're building. It's that we're able to look very specifically about our successes, and if we do have a shortcoming, why we weren't successful. But it's also tasking the student and giving them agency with developing their own journey. So when I come to make a visit, those students are developing their professional objectives, and then making the visit, they are tasked with guiding the conversations on how they have met that objective or how they have fallen short of that objective. And then from there, talking through a plan of attack to either build on how we were successful or to remediate if we weren't. So although all those visits, the students are the center of the stage, and they're the ones that are given the platform to talk. And oftentimes it's very difficult that we have individuals in leadership positions at our golf courses that love to show off their course. They love to talk and engage with us, and we love that. But it's all about the students. It's all about the apprentices first. And so they're the ones that are given the platform to guide those conversations. At the beginning of the year, we really lean heavy on the objective building. And so it corresponds with a toolkit that we give all of the students at the beginning of the year that we say, okay, there's five different levels that we have through conversations with all of our golf courses developed as the foundational levels, working all the way up to what we would expect a first assistant superintendent to be able to complete for a job. And so they are given this toolkit, and from there, they're able to pick out certain skill sets out of the toolkit that they want to focus on. And it really is person dependent. So we have some folks that their first week in the industry is the first week of classes. We have some folks that they're in their eighth or ninth year in the industry. And so they're going to come in at a different level, and we're just trying to move them up levels from where they're at. And so that first field visit is, what level are we at? And what objectives do we need to build by the end of the program that we want to get to move you up to the next level? And so that one is hopefully guided by the students. Oftentimes they'll need a little bit of assistance from their mentor to help kind of work through how they're going to feasibly be able to meet that objective to move up to that next level. But it's a student-driven conversation. And if it's not student-driven, then I'm also taking note of that, so that the next field visit that happens, coaching is given to that student so that they feel more empowered to make that more student-driven. From there, I make a visit later in the spring, kind of early summertime, to check in on those goals. And then my joy comes really from seeing the projects that the students are given that provide them the agency to make decisions. And then also, if they're in a leadership position, to take on the role of managing a crew, a small crew, to complete those projects. So at that point, I come out and I want to check out something on the course that they have done, and then have it be place-based learning for me to see, okay, what decisions were made. A lot of times that's kind of a cool intersection between the stuff that we do on the back end with the educational planning, and then also the actual agronomic stuff. So if we're talking in class about sod, There's oftentimes that time of year I'm coming and I'm actually seeing the sod that they laid. So it's a great connection back into class. And then I can reference that in class that I saw so-and-so last week at Pinehurst number 3, you know, laying down sod. Here's some of the things that they were thinking through. And then when we talk about it in class, it's more authentic. It's real, right? It's actually in our backyard and we're referencing it. So that's always a cool visit to make. Later in the summertime, I'll do another check-in if needed for some students that maybe need a little bit more support, that just, you know, have certain factors that are playing a role in their learning journey, and they just need a small intervention from there to make sure we're back on track. And then in the fall is when we make our final visits. So from there, it's a longer conversation, working first with the mentor to check off our checklist that Apprenticeship NC gives us to make sure that they're going to earn their journey worker card at the end. Then the big conversation is with that student, that apprentice, that is now going to be taking off the apprentice hat and putting back on the normal hat. And for some of them, the normal hat is a part of the crew. For some of them, the normal hat has now become a spray tech, a foreman, an AIT, or a first assistant. So they're going to be getting a promotion. And so they're putting that hat on. And we say, okay, now that you're done with the program, you may be done learning at the college, but you're not done learning for the rest of your life in this industry. So how do we help transition you into the next phase and develop professional learning goals moving forward? So that's a long meeting, but it's a tremendously awesome meeting because you know that the next couple of years of their life are, that's the trajectory is based in that meeting and based in those last few months of the program. So I'll start those in a couple of weeks and get out there and meet with each one of the students. And from there, what's really, really cool is that we get to go back and look at that document that they made in January and February at the beginning of the program and compare. And we get to check that off that, yeah, we developed these objectives. And like over the last 12 months, you did it. You did those things and how well we did on them. So it's a celebration. And those meetings, I think, are not what set our program apart, because I had that same kind of meeting and support in my program at Michigan State. But we are very fortunate that all of these placements are here locally versus at a bigger university. You might have students that are placed all over the world. So I can make more visits, more field visits to the students, and then we can have more elaborate developed meetings, and so that we can have higher touch points in the field and those students feel supported.
Is this just a one-year program, or how long does it take to complete from front to back?
Yeah, just 1 year. So they start in January, end in December. That's intentional because for this group of students, it is important that they actually are able to see the light at the end of the tunnel, that they feel like this is something that they can take on. And I also like it as well because it lights a fire under me to make sure that I get everything that I can done in that year. Right. And so, yeah, we're aggressive. We take what you might see in a traditional associate's degree program and some of the coursework that they might do over the course of a semester. We boil that down into a month. So we're not able to drill down quite as far with some things, but we're able to cover enough that they've now had that exposure. And if they want to engage more, they can. And especially with conversations on the golf course with their mentors and then any other kind of continuing education. So we're working out a pathway, what it would look like for those students to transition over to the associate's degree side if they so choose, if they want more education, they've been bit by the bug and they want to get more. And then our goal is to start to work with some of the four-year programs. So if a student comes into GAP, they take a year, it should count for some coursework in their program. And then they should be able to move over if they want to complete that. So if they get a taste of it and say, I'm willing to make a sacrifice and do more. So, yeah, that 1 year is important. We know that some of the models outside of the U.S. have multiple years. So you might have an apprentice level 1, 2, or 3 in Australia, or maybe even a 4. We would like to see that as well. But then it kind of gets back into, okay, you know, is this something where it's a brief intervention that they can really spend a lot of time digging into for that year, and they know that it's possible to achieve after that year, that journey worker card, versus staring down the barrel of, you know, more years. So we'll continue to work with that, but for now, it's a really good equation for us to have them start at the beginning of the year, finish at the end of the year.
Well, in multi-year programs, when you're dealing with non-traditional students too, you run the risk of them investing a year, 2 years, maybe three. Something in life happens and you put all that time into something and might not be able to complete it.
Yep. Absolutely. So, yeah. You want it to be something where that for that year, they can isolate, you know, their time and efforts into it. And Yeah, things, life happens, right, to all of us. And as a mostly adult learners in the program, I've had a couple students that are younger, but most all of our students are a little bit older. Yeah, we want to make sure that we're able to mitigate any of those kinds of things that might happen, those variables down the road. So forcing it into that 1 year, a little bit better.
Right. Given the amount of golf courses in the Sand Hills region there in North Carolina, how many have backed this program, and how tough of a sell, if at all, was it to get their support?
Yeah, that's a great question. For some of them, it was as effortless as you can imagine. They've been the ones that are going through stacks of resumes, and they're doing interviews, and they might interview 10 people. And out of those interviews, you know, there might only be a couple really good candidates. And then some of them get the job and they don't even show up, right? Or they show up 1 or 2 days and it's not for them. And we've had that happen with a lot of courses around here. That's tough to get through that. And so for them, working with us means that we'll have somebody that's going to be placed there and supported. So much higher likelihood of that person lasting that year and beyond for them. So, yeah, there's a healthy handful. So we've worked with 13 golf courses to date. Some of those are, you know, one facility with multiple courses. By the end of next year, we'll have another couple. So we'll have 15 under that portfolio. And out of that group, you know, we have a really solid stable of superintendents that are really strong partners with the program, that we know our students are going to be supported when they come to their course. So we've made rounds and made enros, but there's 41 in the county. So we still have a lot of golf courses to go to work with and provide them some support. So some of them, it's an easy sell. Some of them, it's a tough sell because we have a couple requirements in the program that we believe in the support of our students. One is the time that they need to spend in class. So we do 196 hours of coursework over the year, broken into two semesters. And so when we look at the course load, for some of them, they need to leave the course a little bit early and get to class. And then we have class from 2:30 to 4:30. And for some of our golf courses, they need all hands on deck. And it's hard to spare sometimes those students for certain projects that they're doing. So we believe that it's worthy investment in time for them to send their associate over for the program. But just takes a little bit more convincing. The other part of it is the minimum wage. So when somebody comes into the program, we've agreed upon with the state of North Carolina a prevailing wage for them to feel like they can not worry about bills as much and worry about class and learning more. And for some golf courses, that starting wage is a little too high for them to support. And that's okay. For some courses, we understand that the budgets are tight, and we still have some room to grow in that regard to figure it out for them. And so other golf courses, they're able to afford that. And those end up becoming the partners that we know are going to support the students financially. And that's a huge thing. You know, we all know that we've all been in a position where if we're worrying about bills, we're not worrying about other things. And we want to make sure that we mitigate any of those distractors from those students, and that they're able to appreciate the coursework and not have to worry about their financial situation. So that's a big part of it for us, not worrying about tuition, not worrying about buying books. Only worrying about the experience in the program. So those two things have been not necessarily a barrier, just there's always conversations that we got to smooth through. But I think, man, adding a couple more courses on the portfolio next year that we know we're going to have, and then continuing to build from there. People in this town talk, and they talk very positively about things. It's a very tight-knit community that wants to support each other. So as we go along, the best marketing is going to be the word of mouth.
Right. Given the fact that you have students coming into this program from different backgrounds, different levels of experience, how do you tweak the education portion of this? Because you can't really, you can't start everybody at the same spot.
Yeah, that's the toughest part. I have students that would be very successful if they were at North Carolina State right now in a bachelor's program. I have students that, they need a lot of support in class, that they have, they not only need learning accommodations, but they are students that have been diagnosed with disabilities and challenges that need catering to. So having those two different kinds of students walk into class and having something prepared for them, there are days where it's challenging. And not only in the preparation for class, but then once I get into class, I'll throw out a formative assessment to get a gauge of where we're at. And some students are moving at light speed, and other students, I have to stop and I have to go back. And so with those students, I always try to work with the students that need a little bit more accommodation and always err to their side. Because I think that we've built a really good professional learning community and a good group that becomes a family, right? An academic family, that the students on the higher end, they understand, they know who's in class, and they've worked with each other enough on different projects and different in-class activities. They know who needs a little bit of help. They know who needs things to be slowed down a little bit. And so there's no shame in that. It's a very safe space. And so they're willing to be patient and hold on for a couple extra minutes if we need to go back and go over something, or somebody just needs more time to work something out. And typically, man, when we do TURF calculations, any kind of calculation work, any kind of math, that's the great equalizer, right? That brings everybody together a little closer. As I think it's kind of like what we've talked about on a Monday, right? It's that challenge of coming into work and everybody's going to buy gum. This is going to be tough, but we're all in it together. So math is one of those, but when we pull out those equations, we have to slow down a little bit, and I have to work with specific accommodations for students. In my background, being a high school educator and having multiple degrees in that and a lot of experience, especially with students at that freshman level, that actually tends to be the kind of the level that I bring into this program. I try to work around that 9th to 10th grade level, and that works really well for some of my students that need that support. And then for the students on the top end, what's nice is if I teach to how I would teach and work with those freshmen at the high school level, a lot of times it involves taking more time to develop more engagement in the content. And so we make things a little bit more fun, a little bit goofier sometimes. And they like that. Any of those students that have worked all day long at the golf course, when they come to class, last thing they want to do is see 75 slides like we would at a conference, right? And so if we're coming in there, we're doing something a little bit unique. They most oftentimes appreciate that they're going to do something that is going to keep them awake, keep them engaged and motivated. Pushing forward on some of those projects, that's where I take the top end and I'm able to push them a little bit further. So I'm able to cater to them a little bit more. And oftentimes that involves them talking with their mentors at the course, which at that level, if I have some first assistants in the course, their mentors are superintendents. And so when I task them with a project, they need to ramp up that project and have more conversations with their superintendents. And I expect more to be turned in with their projects. And so there's an outline in the rubrics that'll ask for those things. And what's nice is typically these are individuals who are really motivated in the industry to just want to learn more for their benefit. And so I give them a little push, and then from there, momentum takes off and they have more conversations with their superiors. They'll typically have more conversations with other people on the crew, and it really does take care of itself in that regard, because I already have lifelong learners at that point. So I'm very lucky, very blessed that a lot of times that top end is taken care of already. But those are things that we, going forward, the years after, I'm going to continue to work on how I can challenge both sides of the spectrum.
Now, looking through the program, each student has what you call a capstone at the end of the year. What might a capstone project be? Can you walk us through that, please?
Yeah, so a typical university program, maybe not necessarily in TURF, but sometimes in TURF, and then other times, you know, I look at a program like an engineering baccalaureate degree, where you would have a capstone that would be like a senior thesis, right? You would develop some sort of thing that's the culmination of all of the coursework that you've taken in that degree pathway, and it's presented there, right? It's a celebration of all the things you've learned. In our program, we kind of break that out a little bit. So we do a research project over the summertime. The students are tasked with conducting some sort of research that is going to benefit their course. So we're not talking about super rigorous, you know, intensive research trials like you would see at a graduate degree level in a TURF program. We're looking at something that's much more based in citizen science, and they have a question about what they see at their course, and we can investigate it. So they're given that in May, and then they carry that out over the summertime. And then in August, they take that research and synthesize it together to build a poster. And so each one of them has a research poster that they're able to show off the work that they did and the conclusions that they were able to draw from their data collection. So that really is kind of a capstone. And we take advantage of that because that summer growing season, that's when they're engaged on the course. And then we don't have to worry about coursework. So their plate's lessened a little bit, and they can add more under their plate on the data collection side. And that was amazing this year to see all of the diversity of the projects that the students presented and the ways they were able to do it and the ways they were able to push themselves. A lot of those students had not done anything in the rigorous science realm in a while. And so for them to dust off those skill sets and to be able to put it on display was great. So we went over to the World Golf Hall of Fame and we had a poster exhibition, and folks from the community were able to come in and check it out. And again, celebrate the students and how amazing each one of their experiences has been and how amazing they are. So then from there, when we transition back into the fall, we work towards an integrated pest management plan that the students develop for each one of their golf courses. And that is, in a way, a capstone project, because a robust integrated pest management plan should involve a lot of different agronomic concepts together. And so that'll be something that they'll share after Thanksgiving. And then from there, the semester's over pretty quickly. So we don't necessarily need to work towards any kind of big final project that would maybe be something more elaborate and more akin to a summative assessment that you would see in a traditional course. Our goal is to make sure that everything in class is transferable to a skill set that they would need at the actual course. And so having them give some sort of, 30-minute presentation, there's going to be times where they're going to talk at the course, but that's not a thing that you would typically do on the job. Developing an integrated pest management plan, sitting down and reviewing data and developing a strategy moving forward that you would have on file, that is something they would do at the course. So that's why we have that as a project that they would do at the end of that unit. So that's upcoming. In terms of maybe a capstone project for us as a whole group, last year we were able to do a first green event down on course 10 at Pinehurst as a celebration for the course opening. Having a student in the class actually working on the course, having another prospective student that was part of the build team. And we wanted to open that up to the community. And so all the students took on the roles of leading different stations around one of the greens. And that was the first green event that ended up turning into a capstone project for the class as a whole. We're going to try to do that again this year. It's not something that we always want to lean on, just dependent on the group of students and what they feel like is going to be most beneficial for them. But we were able to do that again on course 2 back in June, right ahead of the U.S. Open, and had a couple of the GAP students that were able to lead some of those rotation workshops. And we'll see. I think that'd be something that I would like to become part of the curriculum. But it's all going to depend on, the willingness of the local superintendents to open up their doors. And most of them are. It's just a matter of finding the right time.
Sure. Given your background, pretty diverse background in turf and education and now, education at the public school level, and now this, tell us how your career came full circle to where you are now, as you graduate from Michigan State, then you do your graduate work at Cornell, you're a teaching environmental science at the school level, and then working for the USGA and helping educate what hopefully the next generation of greenkeeper or superintendent. How did you get from A to B?
Yeah, so I think originally the goal was to be a superintendent at a golf course, because shamelessly, I just wanted to play as much free golf as possible. So, I decided early on my game wasn't good enough to become a teaching instructor. So I was just going to cut grass and be good with it. And I enjoyed that. I worked at, six different facilities over the first 7 years that I was in the industry. And I liked it. And I got to do some really neat internships, including an internship with TurfNet over in Ireland at Mount Juliet. And that was tremendous. I getting to explore the world and getting to do something, but also have the support of TurfNet to do it. I think if anybody wants to Google my name, there'll be a picture of me that makes me look like a baby face back there when I was maintaining that blog. And some of the things that I put in there, man, I would change the grammar up a little bit and add some more flavor in there. But had some really good background experiences working in the turf industry, but realized that maybe not necessarily my passion and talent lied in the specific agronomics. I think it was more on the teaching side. And so it wasn't necessarily like identifying that I was bad at something. It was, what do I enjoy and I feel like I'm actually best at? you know, and could take my talent somewhere. So I think it was probably there was some divine providence there that both my grandparents on my mother's side of the family were teachers. My mom and my aunt on that side are teachers. And then my sister's also a teacher. And my other sister actually has a teaching degree. It really runs in the family. So there was a lot of that of, you know, not wanting to do that. And all of a sudden realizing that that's exactly the thing that I wanted to do. And so my mother, as always, was right all along that I should be a teacher. And so went back to school and then was, teaching high school agri-science in Montague, Michigan. And that was a dream job. Every single day was an absolute blast. And got to do so many different things, including coach high school girls golf and boys varsity golf. I was the boys varsity golf coach for precisely 1 week until COVID hit in 2020. So really cut my teeth there with the first week of practice. And then that was that. So, realized that wanted to go and push myself a little bit further. And I think there's always been a chip on my shoulder. Back when I was applying to get into Michigan State, I got waitlisted for that first semester. And I think that was a little bit of a wake-up call that maybe not necessarily putting a square peg in a round hole. I needed to find what I was good at and then pursue that thing. And as soon as I flipped over to the education degree, getting A's in classes was easy because it was the passion that was there, right? It didn't feel like I was forcing myself. And so I've always followed the path of least resistance. And I think, for a lot of the students, I tell them that, right? That if something feels off, if something feels wrong, it probably is. And if something feels right, then it is. And so, for me, following and along the path of education and delving more into that and going to Penn State to do a doctorate in education, it wasn't easy, but it was like in a way that there was motivation there that was authentic. And I think authentic motivation oftentimes gets perpetuated as ease, right? That you're doing something that you enjoy. So from there, it's really been kind of a tumbleweed following along, looking for opportunities, keeping open to those opportunities. And it was a couple of years ago that there was a podcast. The Fried Egg had an episode that featured Dr. Carroll from now works for MVU. But back in that time was working on some research, and I reached out to her and was interested in what she was doing and carrying on the torch. And then from there, it was networking to meet Dr. Booth, and the rest was history to move into this program. So between networking and just following the path of least resistance, it's landed me into this. And it is strange. It's almost a weird coincidence, like out of a movie, that, you know, this position is exactly my entire background academically and with work experience, that it's here. And so, I'm most certainly still not an expert, and I still come into class and fumble my way around all the time, but at least the experience is there enough that I can kind of find my way around in the dark.
Project out into the future a few years. Where would you like to see this program in several years? How do you anticipate its growth? What's next?
Yeah, so I think it's all about following where we have a nexus of golf and community support. And so when you look at Myrtle Beach, how many golf courses there are down there, and then how much community support there is for the golf industry, it's the perfect storm to have the next iteration of this program, because we know that we're going to have student interest. We know that we're going to have support from the courses, and we know we're going to have community stakeholders that are going to want to see a program successful like this. And Horry Georgetown Technical College has an unbelievably robust two-year program down there that's a national leader. And so adding to their toolkit an apprenticeship model even is gives them another thing to be able to help service the community even more. And so then looking at other markets like out in Scottsdale, where you have a huge concentration of courses, and then identifying some educational partners there, that might be a next step. And then just looking around the country where you have a density of golf courses and then also community support. That's kind of the equation right now for where we need gap. Now, part of that also, though, is identifying the industry needs. And so when we're doing this and thinking about it, we've got to say, okay, well, is a Journey Worker Card something that would result at the end of a one-year program that we're building now? Is a Journey Worker Card enough? And that's a big thing that we're now entering into with doing needs assessments and having conversations with our golf course partners. When somebody gets into GAP and they commit a year of their life to this and they've demonstrated the kind of motivation and the upward trajectory that they are going to have leading the program, are they going to get rewarded with a commensurate position? And so we have some students from last year's cohort that have been promoted to a first assistant, and that's a game changer. They're making a salary. They can rest easy knowing that they're going to have a common or constant paycheck. And then this year's cohort will have two more students that'll get promoted to first assistant once they earn their journey worker card. So do we know that all of our golf course partners have those pieces in place from an HR standpoint or, you know, a handbook standpoint to hire on somebody with a journey worker card and provide them the same opportunities that we would expect with other education? We don't think that this needs to replace a four-year degree and shouldn't, because we want to make sure that we still continue to have individuals that commit to 4 years of training or 2 years of training and have that robust scientific background. But we should be able to offer the people that commit to something like this a prevailing wage where they can achieve some sustainability for a career. And so, yeah, any place that we're going to expand to, those kind of conversations have to be had as well. All right, you're willing to take this on. You're willing to mentor the students. Are you willing to opt for the opportunity to give them the pathway to move up to a position that might be a salary position at some point, might offer those opportunities for them to apply more critical thinking at work? And we know that that's going to end up being a return because they're going to want to stay there.
Well, it sounds like a pretty exciting endeavor and certainly worthwhile as just the world changing at breakneck speed and everybody's situation in it. And it's neat to see something so well organized, targeted toward the non-traditional student, and the adult lifelong learner. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure that it must be tremendously rewarding for you to be part of this.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you see people change, and I think, you know, that's kind of self-serving, but that's why I wanted to become a teacher, right? You want to make a difference. You want to have an exponential impact. And so when we see our students that are growing like they are, and knowing that when they work at a golf course and they assume a position of leadership and they're going to have people that they hire on that they're going to be able to impact, that becomes a really powerful, humbling thing, knowing that, you know, some of the things that we do in GAP might be impacting an exponential group of people that are coming into the industry. That's the goal, right? We want to leave it better than what we had it. And so if we're able to continue to pursue that, and I think that we're going to be successful.
Well, Carson, it was great catching up with you. I really appreciate your time, and always good to see a friendly and familiar face and just to find out that things are going so well, not only with you, but with the apprenticeship program as well. So thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the continued partnership with TurfNet. A world leader in this space and a very, very valuable asset to have with the industry.
It's the easiest thing you'll have to do all day. it's really exciting. It's, you know, I consider myself a lifelong learner, and you know, after you've graduated, you know, from college, and you're have all other obligations and constraints on your time. You know, you have to seek out those things that fit your lifestyle.
Yeah.
And, you know, like one of the things I'm doing now, I'm totally immersing myself in a couple of foreign languages that I learned in high school and one that I learned in college. And I'm after several years away from that, doing both concurrently now, which is it's funny. There are some words between the two that are, I'm taking German and Russian. And there are some words between the two that are very similar, but mean totally different things. And I found myself now getting confused using Russian words in German and German words in Russian, and it doesn't work.
Yeah. My girlfriend used to be a high school Spanish teacher. And now when she moved down with me to North Carolina here, she's transitioned into working in social media marketing for a university. So it's nice to get to use her educational background to, you know, better serve marketing for educational programs. And so she's fluent in Spanish, obviously, and studied abroad and then used it as a teacher and then still does some tutoring on the side. But then she also has learned German and now working on Japanese. And so
you're right.
Like when you have a proclivity for that, it's, you know, you kind of hunger for it and you get a lot of feedback and a lot of gratification knowing, all right, if I can communicate with somebody, then when you have that conversation, right, how powerful it is. So we went over to Austria and Germany this summer and she was, you know, when we would go to a restaurant, she would, you know, order in German and do her thing, but it got us in a hot water a couple of times because she's so convincing that the people then all of a sudden start rattling off a really quick conversation and she's good, but needs just a little bit more training, right, to get to that point where it's, you know, transcending into deeper conversation. So she'd have to kind of whoa the horse and be like, okay, hold on a second. we got to slow down a little bit. And if we're going to talk, we have to go back to some more simple language. So we're going to go to Japan next year for the International Turf conference there in Tokyo. So she's doing the Japanese right now, but she's like, okay, like I need to know enough, but not know enough to be dangerous. Right. And kind of balance. Right. But yeah, I hear you on the German. She does her lessons every day. And there's a couple words that I'll pick up here and there, but I'm an absolute doofus when it comes to learning a foreign language. So I think God bless me with some talents, but learning language is not one of them. I can barely master English.
Yeah. Well, and the good thing about German and English is that English at some point is a weed that grew out of German.
Yep.
So it's not totally unfamiliar or, you know, a lot of similarities between English and German. So now I do have a question bringing up Spanish. At any point in the future, is there an opportunity or a reason to include a Spanish component to this apprenticeship program for non-English speakers?
Yeah, so we've talked about it. One of the big ones. So in this area, you don't see a huge amount of primary Hispanic workforce crews, right? Like you might see maybe up like when I was at Philly Cricket this summer, right? It's like they've got the vast majority of the crew are Hispanic workers, and so you don't see a lot of that in our area. Maybe a little bit west into the mountains, you see it a little bit more. Some of the conversations I had with some of the superintendents, you know, I brought that up that, hey, this could be a really valuable thing. But they immediately came back to me with, well, those workers are here for, you know, a bit and then they leave, right? They're part of the H programs. And so, they weren't super interested in it for them. But there has been some conversations given the GCSAA and what they do with Spanish, translation and Spanish specific workshops. And now what the USGA is going to do with coming out with a Spanish version of the Green Section Record and more education materials that are in Spanish, I think what we'll be able to do is not necessarily offer GAP, you know, the 1 year journey worker card program in Spanish, but be able to offer like workshops and things that are like one-offs that cater to a Spanish speaking audience. And so it's an iron in the fire that I think we'll eventually get to. I think another thing to look at just from that kind of perspective is just working more with kids and youth. And so like, we're not going to have a high school student take GAP, but what could that look like if we were to do something with high school students, to support them? And so, that's the conversation right now, including also the hybrid programming. And like, I know that a hybrid program is just not going to work well, you know, like an online program. And then the programs that work well for the online component, those programs are great, like what Penn State and Rutgers have. But it's just to get the piece of paper, right? Like I got to take the online classes so I get the paper at the end so that I know that I can get that promotion. And those are individuals that are typically a little bit more motivated to finish, and that money's out of pocket versus for us, like we need something that offers the in-person like camaraderie building. In class and that they're going to be engaged hands-on. I, out of my students, I bet 12 out of the 14 would not have made it to where we're at right now if everything was exclusively online. So that's a hurdle that we're going to have to jump. And there's been a lot of demand, but I think a lot of people that are demanding it because everybody else is doing it. And then that's the way that the snowball is rolling. But that's just, we're not going to be successful in that space. And we're just going to have to kind of hold our ground on it.
Good deal. Well, Carson, again, appreciate your time. Good catching up, and best of luck to you with this with the apprenticeship program.